All right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. And this is our Brexit Bitches episode. And thankfully, unfortunately, we're not going to have my usual co-host Christian on. He had a family emergency, so that's a sad story. But we invite on Chad again. Are you still in existence, Chad?
That's right. I'm my Christian 5.0.
Christian 5.0. There are that many versions already?
That's right. One of the Gracies was famous for saying about Brazilian. A guy asked him how he kept beating him every single time. He goes, "Listen, I know everything you know, and everything else."
Yay for MMA! They're probably like three people that understood that, and two of those people are me and you. And as for our guest, we actually have somebody that got to vote for the Brexit, and that is Harris. So thank you, Harris, for coming on and actually talking about stuff that Americans pretend to actually know all the details about but weren't actually there to vote about it.
Well, thank you for having me.
And before we get into the topic, I wanted to ask, if you have not always been a libertarian, what was your political leaning beforehand, and how did you become a libertarian?
Well, I switched between various viewpoints before I was a libertarian. I come from a fairly conservative family, so that's where I started out, and then I looked into other political belief systems. I started to think government should be this great force to provide greatest good for the greatest number of people, so I was kind of a utilitarian. I believed in national healthcare, national education, that kind of stuff. And then I moved on to being more into direct democracy, believing that what the majority says should be how we run the country. And then I started browsing the internet, going on discussion pages, and I saw these people who were called libertarians, and they were talking about these crazy things like making guns and drugs and prostitution legal, and I thought, oh my god, how dangerous is this for society? I ended up reading more into it, and I went onto the website of the Libertarian Party of the UK, and it had these three words that just really hit me. It said, "You own yourself." And I don't think I've ever read a truer three words than those. And I became even more interested. I started to look into what libertarianism was in more detail. And I got hold of the audiobook of Murray Rothbard's For a New Liberty and The Ethics of Liberty. And I've never really looked back from there.
Well, other than that being one of the coolest stories ever, you also have the best accent we've ever had on this show. So.
Very much. I wish I could speak all of my words in your accent.
I kind of feel like that accent, somebody could say, "I am going to stab your cat and wipe my ass with it," in that accent. And I would be like, "Oh, that's so charming. Please tell me more."
Well, you want to know a great story about accents. So, in the United States, like, my accent, there's like a big twinge of southernness. I'll say things like y'all and everything. But, you know, I'm from Florida. I don't really have much of an accent. But I did a semester in Australia, and I finally got to experience what British people coming to America feel like, where people think that you sound really cool just because you're a novelty act. It was awesome. And actually, one of their favorite words to hear me say was awesome. Because they're like, they're trying to do an impression, but they're like, awesome! Like, because they're always like, awesome, awesome.
Like, that's not how you say it. Like, awesome.
No, I'll pick however the Australians say anything over how the American, I love their accent.
Yeah, I'm sorry, American accents, even though I like to claim that we say everything correctly. But
yeah, well,
Well, we don't actually speak English. We speak American.
And the other countries speak English. No, sorry. We don't speak American. We speak American. Thank you.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, Harris, before we get started, can you explain to us just briefly, I know a lot of things, but here's one of the things that I don't know. What does Britain refer to versus the UK versus England? So is Britain, is that the whole island of Great Britain? When you're saying Britain, what does that encompass?
Well, it can mean different things, but I usually say Britain to refer to the whole of the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom includes four constituent countries, which you can kind of compare to US states, which are Scotland, England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. That's the United Kingdom. Yeah, now, there's the island of Great Britain, which is within that. Which adds confusion to things.
Well,
it'll be interesting to see how much longer there is a united UK following the Brexit vote.
Yes, well, liberty, bitches. That's what I gotta say. All right, so speaking of Brexit, Harris, if you don't mind actually explaining as best you can what Brexit really was, because I know this was something that was not the spur of the moment on June 23rd. They were like, you know, guys, let's go ahead and leave the EU. How about that? We put it to a vote.
Yeah, well, it's been a long time coming. UK first joined the European Economic Community in the 1970s, and back then it was kind of a trading relationship only, but then throughout the 80s and 90s, it developed more into a kind of supranational government. And David Cameron, who was our Prime Minister until just after the Brexit vote, offered this referendum to kind of get rid of the threat of this right-wing party called UKIP, the UK Independence Party. And he thought if we have an EU referendum, it's an easy chance for us to shoot them down so that we can stay in the EU and the Conservatives can stay in power, you know, for the end of time. And in the end, it just really backfired on him. The UK was one of the 28 member states of the EU, and now we're at the stage where we have had the referendum. It's not legally binding, but everybody expects that we're going to withdraw from the EU in the next 2 to 4 years. And become an independent country, like we used to be.
Mm, that's the key, used to be. Ain't nothing like wanting to be independent. Well, Chad, when you heard about Brexit, what exactly did you hear it was when you looked it up and heard about it? Can you explain what you thought it was?
Yeah, so... you know, the real intention of the referendum really had nothing to do with giving British or United Kingdom citizens the possibility of leaving the EU. It was really the opposite of that. It was, listen, we're going to vote so you guys can shut the fuck up and we never have to hear from you again. The ironic part is when it comes to referendums for the EU to seize power, when it came to ratifying the Treaty of Lisbon, the Maastricht Treaty, whatever the hell they call it, one of those treaties. So when they wanted Ireland to join, they put it to a vote in Ireland, and the Irish voted it down. So what did they do? You know, of course, good democratic leaders that they are, they decided to just have another referendum. It'll be interesting to see what really comes of the whole Brexit referendum. You know, it's not necessarily said and done. They could push for another referendum. They could just never really take this into account. There's a lot of possibilities that could come out of this vote.
We have people out on the streets today doing a hashtag March for Europe who are trying to protest for the result to be overturned. And, you know, there's constitutional experts who've come out and said, well, Parliament is sovereign, this was just an advisory vote. So Parliament doesn't have to actually leave the EU. We can just ignore what the people have told us to do.
Yeah, well, Brett... Sorry.
I mean, it just sounds like a great recipe for our whole democracy to fracture.
Oh, yeah.
And for all of the mainstream parties to completely lose power. If you really want to stay in the EU that much, then good luck to you, but you're going to, you know, damage the political system for a whole generation in the process.
Yeah, well, there's really no way for them to go about it where they don't piss off at bare minimum 49% of people. The best case scenario, they're pissing off 49% of people. Brexit is a great lesson in sort of what happens when the elites and the media and the financial institutions and the betting markets and everyone gets something completely wrong. I woke up on Friday. No one expected Brexit to happen. No
yeah,
one expected
real.
It because every poll that you looked at said it wasn't going to happen. Every news channel you turned on said it wasn't going to happen. Everybody you talked to over in England said, you know, well, it's probably going to be defeated. And it unleashed a whole bunch of chaos in the financial markets that's since been walked back and since, you know, everything's set down once they figured out, hey, this isn't, you know, we didn't just get hit by an asteroid. But it was very interesting to watch the reaction of a lot of these very powerful, well-connected people when they weren't getting what they want.
Well, I mean, what the best parts were the scare tactics. That's my favorite. Everybody that was like, oh, no, you shouldn't do this, you know, it's bad, but we'll get further into that at the start, since we've now covered basically what it is. I'm going to go into...
Can I ask something real quick? I want to ask Harris a question.
Oh,
because,
go ahead.
What I saw from this side of the Atlantic is I saw before the vote, a whole lot of fear-mongering on behalf of everyone on the Remain side, saying, there's going to be this giant recession, we have these models, we're going to be like 7% poorer, and blah, 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 blah. And then the vote goes through, and then all of 2 days later, there's this sort of reformulating of the narrative where everyone says, all the Leave people, they were doing the fear-mongering, but it was about immigrants. They were just spreading all this fear and xenophobia. And I was like, I never once heard any kind of a fear-mongering tactic out of anyone advocating for the Brexit. But yet, ever since the Leave vote happened, all I've heard is fear-mongering, fear-mongering, fear-mongering on behalf of the Leave people, when it was the exact opposite. I don't know if you saw any of this or if it was different actually in Britain, but I'm just sort of getting the call from the internet.
You're exactly right. And I think the reason that they went with what we were calling Project Fear throughout the campaign, because they looked at previous elections which had been similar. They looked at Quebec in Canada, they looked at Scotland in 2014, and they looked at our last general election in 2015. And they decided that playing to people's fears and, as they put it, emphasizing the risks was the best way to make people vote for the status quo, because they're worried about their jobs, about their future, about their pensions. And if you say, oh, we'll just keep things as they are, then people go, oh, okay, nothing will ever be wrong if we stay in the EU then.
Yeah, and with all the Londoners specifically, they're all worried about their property value. That literally came down to, well, if we leave the EU, the value of my house might go down.
Yeah, I mean, every single area of life you can possibly imagine, there was a Project Fear scare story for it. On my Facebook feed, I'm subscribed to a few of these food pages which show you videos of people making meals, and they're putting out these stories like, price of beer and food is going to go up if Britain leaves the EU. I don't think there's anything that they weren't afraid was going to be utterly destroyed if we left. And I have to say, on the fear-mongering point about xenophobia, as you were saying, they decided after the result came in that Leave had been the pessimists. They were actually one of the most optimistic campaigns I've ever seen in politics. But it was the Remain side, it was David Cameron who was saying, if we stay in the EU, then we'll have all these brilliant links with European border agencies so that we can keep out having too many refugees in the country. So these people who are saying that Leave are the only ones who are whipping up sentiment about immigration is complete rubbish.
Oh, of course it is, yeah. And one of the ironic things that I saw from it is, I don't know how you could have run a Project Fear campaign to get people to change. Fear is a great tool for the status quo, because Leave inherently implied something unknown. And so, you know, given that things aren't currently on fire and falling apart in Britain, how could you possibly run a fear campaign to torch the status quo? It wouldn't work. And yet, you know, everybody that gets on Twitter, and God, I fucking can't stand it. It's mostly left-wing Americans mm-hmm. that were just bitching nonstop about all the fear mongering. I'm going to be brave and not be afraid of immigrants, et cetera, et cetera. Because Harris said, like, anybody who was there, you can't deny that this is what happened, but they're going, just like what happened in Orlando, they're going to change the narrative after the fact, and they're going to repeat it so many times that no one will remember at the end of the whole thing what actually happened.
Okay, going off that, we're already going into the first topic that I wanted to bring up. So, one of the things that narratives I definitely heard from the left, as you were bringing up, was the xenophobia. And now, xenophobia, not exactly something that I thought was the thing. I didn't think this was something that was an indicator, at least when I was researching what Brexit was, you know. But at the same time, I mean, a lot of people were saying, okay, so they voted for people to, you know, to have immigrants. They said, okay, so they allowed immigrants to come in, and all of a sudden they want to bitch about it, is one of the things that I heard from people. And I also questioned them. I said, okay, who is this they that voted for, supposedly voted for immigrants to come in? And was this a true representation of all of the people? And really, was xenophobia actually an indicator? So I'm going to throw that one to Harris to answer first.
Well, to give you some background about why immigration was a factor in the EU debate, because the EU involves this free movement of people as one of its core principles. Every member state, you have to be able to move to any other if you want to live or work there. And as a libertarian, that's of course something that appeals to me. As someone who loves Europe and, you know, loves traveling around there, I think that's a great thing. But it is a factor, because we had, you know, over a million people, especially from places in low-income countries in Eastern Europe, came to the UK. And I think for people in some professions, they did become employed in those areas, and it did create a downward pressure on wages. Now, you know, I, as somebody who believes in a competitive free market, I'm not going to say that a job belongs to the person who holds it. A job belongs to whoever can do it at the best price and please the customer. But it was a factor in the referendum. But let's be clear about it. It wasn't the main factor, and it wasn't the primary motivator for people who voted Leave. We've had three polls which would support that. There's one which came from Lord Ashcroft, which found that 49% of people voted leave because they thought the Britain's laws should be made in Britain. Only 33% of people said their main motivation was to reduce immigration. There's a poll from Comres, 53 or 54% said national sovereignty was most important. Only 34% said immigration. And there was another poll which asked if we could have the kind of arrangement that Norway has, where you have complete free movement of people in Europe. You're not bound by all of the EU rules and regulations, and you can make your own trade deals. Would you support or oppose that? Well, only 25% of people in the country opposed that. So to paint this as a xenophobic or racist vote just doesn't seem to line up with the fact.
Oh my goodness. So, you mean there was more to the narrative? No, there we go, America. I love when we pretend we know everything.
Well, just to add something to that, so, you know, on... just to play devil's advocate for a moment, I'm going to kind of halfway play devil's advocate. I don't think it's possible to unlink national sovereignty and immigration, because part of the idea of national sovereignty is that you, that your people as a nation get to decide their immigration policy. And I think that's very important. You know, we all sort of, as libertarians, have this ideal that anybody should be able to move, you know, wherever they want. But I believe it was Milton Friedman that said you can either have open borders or a welfare state, but you can't have both. And I think that's a very important factor when you're looking at the migrant crisis and you're looking at where are these people going? They're going to Germany, they're going to Sweden, they're going to Britain. Why? Two reasons. One, the economies are better there, and two, the welfare benefits are better there. The, you know, there's a reason they're not all stopping off to live in Hungary or where Alexander the Great.
Where most of them arrive, I think, from over the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the southern European countries are struggling heavily right now. In the northern European countries, not so much, but the immigration question is not central, but essential to the vote leave, and it's essential to the question of national sovereignty. You know, does your country have the right to decide, you know, who it comes in, what kind of people, and how many people come in? And there's nothing inherently xenophobic about that. Something when I lived in Australia. I was very fond of is that both the left and the right in Australia are extremely pro-border security. You know, and when it comes to immigration, this idea that has infected America and the Western European countries that we have to take everybody is just not even remotely realistic. Look at what other countries, non-Western European countries do. They, you know, Japan, when it comes to taking refugees, Japan, when it comes to taking Syrian refugees, says no thank you. They say we like our society the way it is, we're going to keep it that way. This idea that there's a moral obligation on behalf of the West to take in people who, you know, aren't going to integrate into society. I don't like the assumption that somehow if you're against it, that you're inherently xenophobe or that you're inherently a racist. You know, my ideal immigration system for as long as the government exists is just to give people an SAT test. And, you know, if you get above a 1500 or a 1400, doesn't matter your skin color, boom, come in. You know, we want as many smart people of every skin color that we can get, and you guys can keep your dumb fucks.
That's awesome. It's like, here, we have a test for you in your language. You're an idiot. No thanks.
Yeah, sorry. We don't need your low-skilled workers. We need your high-skilled workers. You guys are welcome. You dumb fucks, I'm sorry. Have kids. Maybe they'll be smart. Maybe they can come in.
That's awesome.
Call me a racist. Try to be racist. a colorblind intelligence test.
Do you think everybody will be able to, people within America and within the UK will be able to fill all of the low-skilled job vacancies? Do you think that, people who are brought up here will be able to pick fruit in a field for 12 hours a day? Or do you think that immigration is sometimes needed?
When it comes to things like, the argument is made all the time, we need the Mexicans to come pick our tomatoes. We don't, because currently there are more, if you look at the number of people employed in farming in America, it's more than 50% white, Native Americans. Not Native Americans as in Indians, but, born here and everything. The problem is that when you bring those people in, as you said, the wages go down, and then all of a sudden it's, now picking tomatoes is the job Americans won't do. Putting the downward prices on wages also hurts, companies' desires to innovate. They're not going to innovate if they don't have to.
Well, there's also the fact that when it comes to unskilled workers, that's kind of where your younger people should be learning some of that hard work and skill. That's certainly exactly what I had to do at about 13 and a half. I actually worked on a farm where I had to clean up this big-ass ranch and that had, all this horse shit on it. And it took hours because it was huge and it took a lot of labor. But if our millennials are any indication, there definitely need to be some young people learning what that is, or else they wouldn't be arguing for that damn 15 all the time, saying, you need to learn what some actual work is. So that's where that unskilled work needs to come from. It's not from immigrants. It literally needs to come from young people who, are just growing up and getting ready to get in the workforce, or else they wouldn't be, working at, McDonald's and, at their cash register thinking they're supposed to get $15 at their first job. Yep, I don't know where Chad went, but...
I just ran into somebody real quick. Did you repeat that?
Oh, I was just talking about how your unskilled workers just come from, the young people who, wouldn't have this fight for 15. Yeah, we wouldn't have this fight for 15 if they were just, learned how to be unskilled workers when they were younger.
Exactly. I'm not supposed to stay at a minimum wage job to raise a family. He's just saying, you don't need a $15 an hour minimum wage when you stay there for a couple of years when you're 18. Then, and also better things.
Yeah, but since we're talking a lot about the youth, we might as well go into the... why was it that the older crowd seemed to be the ones who largely voted to leave the EU, as opposed to the younger people who I love seeing. I wish I would have had the quote ready about how the young people were like a message to the older people, how the older people just ruined their lives by voting to leave. And the older people, I was all like, the older people seem to be the smart ones, because a lot of the older people probably saw some terrible, terrible things. And all the young people was like, oh, you ruined our future. I'm like, hello, these people have existed longer than you've been breathing on the earth. They probably saw a hell of a lot more than you've seen.
And that's the thing. They'll put these memes out saying, why should we have our future dictated for us by people who only have 10 or 20 years left to live? And they just don't see the flip side of that. Well, because they've lived for 40 or 50 years more than you have, and they've had more life experience. That's the great equalizer in these things. And the truth is that young people just didn't turn out in sufficient numbers to vote Remain and have that result succeed. I mean, I've got the numbers in front of me.
That's perfect.
36% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted. 83% of 65-plus-year-olds voted.
Well, repeat that, please.
There's a very obvious reason why the old people turned out in bigger numbers. Now, I can explain some of my theories about why older people might have voted for Brexit and younger people might have voted for staying. I mean, the first reason I can think of is because the older people were there in the 1970s when we voted to enter mm-hmm. the European Economic Community, as I mentioned earlier, and they saw how it changed and developed into this continental super state, which mm-hmm. is trying to regulate almost every aspect of our daily lives. If you've seen Brexit, the movie,
yeah,
you'll
I did.
Have seen that great segment where the man wakes up on his EU-regulated pillow, and he stands up on his EU-regulated floor, and he walks into his EU-regulated shower and dries himself off with his EU-regulated towel. I just don't think that young people have had much business experience as older people to know how petty and how omnipresent these EU regulations are. And I think there's another point, which is just a misconception, really. Younger people feel more international because they've been on more holidays abroad, they have more friends of different national origins. So they may feel more European, but I think they just conflate loving Europe with loving the EU. And it's like Thomas Paine said, you know, a patriot, someone who loves his country but doesn't love his government. But I think a lot of these people can't distinguish between a geographical area and the government of that geographical area.
Yeah, there's so one of the things that I wanted to interject that I think just frustrates the hell out of all libertarians when they see a meme like that where you've got the younger people saying, why should the older people dictate to us, you know, the our futures? And it really becomes, you know, us versus them, young versus old, when all the libertarians see it and go, hey, no one should dictate your future to you, and you shouldn't dictate someone else's future to them. Like, this could have been a great opportunity for a bunch of young people to say, you know, maybe this whole idea of democracy and referendum, maybe this isn't such a great idea, because we actually are being dictated to. Our preferences don't matter because we've been outnumbered.
And some of them have been saying that to some extent, that we shouldn't be ruled by the mob, which many libertarians would agree with. But all they're suggesting to replace it is being ruled by the elite. And, you know, on the question line of national sovereignty, I'd rather side with the mob than the elite any day of the week.
Well, but when they say that, they're really saying, no, we should be ruled by the mob who agrees with us.
Yes.
That's what it comes down to.
But if you can repeat that percentage of how many young people who apparently are like Bernie Sanders, socialist young people who thought Facebook likes was supposed to count as votes, like how many young people compared to older people again in that percentage?
The number who turned out to vote?
Yes.
36%. I mean, just over one in three.
Oh my God.
It means that over 60% of them sat on their sofa.
And then they bitched afterward. Get off your ass and vote. Like, and then
and there's an actual there's a great picture. It's this, like, semi-famous, I guess, Twitter user, and one of the tweets he's saying, I don't know any of this EU stuff. I'm not bothering to vote today. And then like his tweet the next day is, can't believe we've left the EU, and all of you idiots have dragged us out of it.
Oh my God.
A lot of these people will just, you know, swim with the tide, and that's the nature of being young. You don't tend to care about politics as much as people who've been around for 60 or 70 years, who've come into contact with government, who've worked in business, who've had all these experiences which qualify them to vote, really.
But then, of course, you'll bitch about it. Of course. Oh my God, that's so disgusting.
The young people lack the natural skepticism of politicians and of promises, because you get people who are 50, 60, 70, and they've seen it before. They've been promised all kinds of things before. You know, it's going to be interesting in 2016, all of those people who were coming of age when Barack Obama was elected, and, you know, for anybody that wasn't there in 2008, it's hard to describe how much just this hope and change Barack Obama campaign really energized and impacted people. And then they literally saw everything they thought they were going to get kind of thrown in their faces. And they basically got slightly more liberal George W. Bush for 8 years. And so, you know,
I'm one of those people that voted for Barack Obama and then watched nothing happen. And so I'm a libertarian.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because, you know, you went one direction, and then I think a lot of other people doubled down on that and went, oh, this Bernie Sanders guy, no, this is the guy. Like Obama, he was gonna be that guy, you know, but he got bought off by the elites and the system corrupted him and whatever other fucking excuses they decided to, you know, make up for why Obama didn't deliver on any of the things that he promised. So those young people that, you know, that are coming out to vote, you know, that are voting status quo, they're not inherently skeptical of politicians because they don't have enough experience being lied to and having their, you know, their hopes and dreams just crushed by government.
And if I could jump in there, it was one of the things that had been promised to the older generation time and time again, that politicians had promised, we're going to go to the EU and we're going to renegotiate it so that it just turns into a kind of a market where we can trade goods with each other. This was promised by Edward Heath in the 70s, Margaret Thatcher in the 80s, Tony Blair in the 90s, and it was just lie after lie after lie. The EU couldn't be reformed. It was too centralized. It was too static, and it couldn't be changed in a free market direction, which is what.
Well, and the EU has no interest in being reformed. They don't. The EU would reform itself if the incentives were there or the powers that be to actually do it. But there is no impetus for them to reform because there's a reason why this, what is it, Article 50 or Article 20 or whatever it is, there's a reason that the procedures for exiting are ridiculously complicated because they were never designed to be used.
Yep. It's ridiculous.
I have one topic that I'd like to kind of bring up as it relates to the whole Brexit thing. I'd like to see, you know, hear what you guys think about it. So when I was looking at the Brexit, I know that, you know, Britain leaving the EU for the EU is not inherently threatening. It's more about what it symbolizes and if it goes well for Britain, that will be a disaster for the European Union because it won't be long before you see France, Italy, the other big countries sort of getting ready to try to get out. You know, there's more than a possibility that, you know, Marine Le Pen might be the next president of France. So when I was looking at sort of how the EU decides to play this, I really think that they are going to, as Nigel Farage said, cut off their nose to spite their face. They're going to try to make this as painful of a process as possible, so in order to scare the remaining countries in the EU away from having a referendum of their own. What do you guys think about that?
Well, duh.
Well, actually, I would say that you might expect that from an organization which has incentive to keep itself in constant power. Let's also remember that the EU still needs Britain's trade, and, you know, supposedly 100,000 German jobs rely on trade with the UK, and so, you know, the Germans are some of the most powerful people in Brussels. Angela Merkel, some people are saying, you know, is the Empress of Europe. So it would be hugely against Germany's interest to stop selling cars to the British. And, you know, they don't want to unleash this chain reaction across Europe of different countries leaving. But Project Fear from the European side has subsided a bit. We've heard some fairly sensible moves from the Germans talking about how there needs to be some kind of trade deal with the UK. We've heard some of the more kind of scaremongery stuff coming from the French side and from the Socialist Party in Germany, from Martin Schulz, who is, you know, one of the most ardent EU personalities out there. He's the Speaker of the European Parliament. Many videos of Nigel Farage slapping him down, which is very entertaining. You know, they don't want to set a precedent, but at the same time, I don't think they do want to cut off their nose despite their face, because they don't want to look like a deformed maniac, and they do still want the countries within the EU to stay there and see it as an appealing option.
Yeah, and also what this does, I know after this, good old Representative Thomas Massie, one of the most libertarian people in our Congress in Kentucky, decided he wanted to make a Megxit, which is a bill that's in the Congress, I guess called H.R. 1205, for the Megxit so that America can leave the UN. So I see this as a positive. Of course, you know, everybody's going to be freaking out, oh, we shouldn't leave. And I think this is going to be a serious battle, because I don't think it's going to be as easy in America for this to happen, especially because Barack Obama was sure to make that speech that it would be a bad idea for the UK to for the Britons to leave, or anybody to leave. It's like, it's bad for trade, blah, 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 which was stupid because it only made them to, like, vote. They're like, no, that's a good idea to leave. Thanks for the scaremongering. That just makes me want to leave even more. But I don't know. I think the scaremongering is just going to go on. I just want to see who's going to be next to leave. But I feel like this, even though everybody's excited about a Megxit and even Texit, because, you know, Texas, to secede and all that good stuff, I feel like America might be leaps behind even getting there, because it feels like now, after Bernie Sanders lit the fire for socialism, America has slid into idiocy too much to get a Megxit or Texit anywhere near where it needs to be for it to actually happen.
Well, there are a couple of sort of major differences in, you know, between those things that work towards Britain's favor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to there is this sort of, there have been these sort of interesting tug of war in the past several years, sort of between more globalist, more multinational type movements versus sort of a decentralization of power, smaller and smaller countries, you know, pushing for things at the local level. You know, in the past, I don't know what it's, 20 years, you've seen the formation of several new countries out there, you know, a few in Africa, couple that, you know, basically in the Middle East, sort of de facto. You've got a Kurdistan, a Shiistan, and a Sunnistan in Iraq. It is interesting to see sort of how this tug of war will play out, because there are very powerful interests on both sides. I think sort of more of the populist interest is on the side of decentralization of power, of bringing things to a smaller and smaller level, for things to get more efficient, for, you know, government and laws and everything to get more tailored to local interests versus, you know, distant bureaucratic super states. You know, but on the other side, you have a lot of money, you know, multinational corporations, political elite, the you know, the cabal of individuals around the world that want to control the remainder of the people, you know, and so it's interesting to see how that'll play out. In terms of why Britain was able to pull this off versus why Texas would not stand a chance, you know, Britain happens to be in a very fortunate position in that, you know, they've really got no military threat to speak of coming out of Europe. You know, they're a nuclear power, so that precludes anybody from ever trying to invade Britain. They've got their own currency. You know, they're more or less independent. They've got a very strong navy. They can kind of do what they want. Whereas, you know, Texas, despite being the second largest state in the United States, we've already seen what happened in United States history when you try to buck Washington, D.C. And it, you know, starts and ends with a lot of bullets and a lot of dead people.
Oh, man. Sad story. But one of the other topics that I want to... We sort of touched on it, and me and Harris kind of touched on it before the podcast, the economic implications of Brexit, that also kind of played a part into why the older generation voted to exit. So one of the things everybody was saying, you know, oh, you know, economically everything was going to be in chaos. And of course, my answer was, of course, everything's going to be in chaos at first, because, you know, everybody, even though they were attached to a big, gigantic welfare state. Of course, you know, what happens when, you know, you detach from a welfare state, you're going to have to figure it out. I feel like if they adopt some sort of, you know, a little bit more capitalism, they might have a chance of surviving there, of course. But there's going to be some chaos. But, Harris, clued me in on to what the state said to some of the poorer older people to try to get them to stay. So if you could go ahead and repeat that, what we were talking about earlier. Yeah.
There are all kinds of threats really coming out of the government. Some of the most, you know, outrageous threats coming from the Chancellor, George Osborne. And he was saying that old people were going to lose their pensions. He was saying that they were going to have to create a Brexit budget. The moment we left the EU, he would have to create an emergency budget, which would have to raise $30 billion in lost revenue because of how damaging it would be to the economy. And that would conveniently enough be £15 billion of tax rises and £15 billion of public spending cuts, just so that the left and the right would be annoyed enough at the idea to be scared by it. So they were pulling out every dirty trick in the book to try and terrify vulnerable people, poor people, old people into staying in the EU as if their lives depended on it. But in the end, it turned out quite interestingly that some of the regions most subsidized by the EU with its regional development money were some of the strongest areas which voted to leave. And, you know, there's a professor at Goldsmiths University in London who he was a leftist, I think. He called it an active self-harm or something. But in reality, what people are doing is saying, I don't want to be treated like a child. I don't want to be told that I depend on a foreign country's welfare handout so that I can continue to exist. The message of the Leave campaign was take back control. And I think that's people, it's what people want. Control over their region, control over their country, and ultimately control over their own life.
You mean their bodies, their own? Like, they have control over their own bodies and minds?
Another person who isn't them doesn't own them. I know it's a strange concept.
Oh my gosh. Did you hear that, Chad?
I did. So I saw speaking of the economic implications, I saw a post on Facebook. I think you might have shared it as well. I originally saw it from Thurman. And it was the We Are Capitalists.
Oh, yeah, that one.
I was about it. And it was like, so-and-so from this university has studied the impact of Brexit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in all of their models, the UK you know, economy is going to be 2% poorer for doing so. We're capitalists. We like business, and we don't want to be poor. And it was just like numbers, numbers, numbers. Like, here's like the 3 points that the Leave campaign was exiting. And I posted back and I said, oh, by the way, you know, these are the same, these numbers are coming from the same people who for the past 30 years have been wrong about everything.
Fucking monetarists.
2000 coming. They didn't see the fall of the Soviet Union coming. They did, you know, they didn't see stagflation coming in the 70s. They have gotten everything wrong. But yet, when it comes to figuring out what the impact is going to be, oh, well, we obviously should take, you know, the outcome of their models because they're definitely going to get this one right. Yeah. It's just like, no, fuck them. They're wrong about everything.
These are the genius economic experts who, many of them signed news, they signed these open letters to major British newspapers in the mid-2000s saying that it would be an economic calamity if we didn't join the euro currency. I mean, no, the people whose university departments funded by the EU, is it any surprise that they're coming out in favor of more European Union?
Yeah.
Well, the only reason Britain could pull this off in the first place is because they don't use the euro. You know, had they been a country that was using the euro, they would have been fucked just like Greece is fucked.
Oh,
had Greece not been on the euro, first of all, this whole, you know, crisis in Greece never would have happened. Mm-hmm. But second of all, Greece would have had some chips at the negotiating table because Frankfurt and Berlin control the purse strings for Greece. They've got no leverage, none.
Yeah, wasn't it? There was a Grexit before there was a Brexit, by the way, because I know Greece tried. But
oh, they tried and they got steamrolled. You know, because Angela Merkel and Wolfgang Schäuble are never going to let Greece live down any of their mistakes.
Harris,
and it's
did you
going
follow
to,
that?
You know, it's going to result in dead Greek people just so the Germans will get paid back 76 cents on the dollar, 45 years from now after they bailed them out six more times.
Harris, did you actually follow that at all when, or did you know about the Grexit?
Yeah, I followed it, not as closely as I have with our own campaign, but I know they rejected the bailout conditions, I think, in a referendum of their own, and the EU just decided to ignore it.
Just like they decided to ignore Ireland's referendum and the Netherlands referendum, and the EU has never won a referendum in any of its member countries. Every time it gets put up, they lose.
Yes, astonishing, even in countries which are considered be the most EU-friendly, like the Netherlands, considered to be a central country, which could be, a big mover for European integration. And they still got rejected there on the EU constitution, and they just got rejected there this year on the Ukraine trade treaty, which would have brought Ukraine into the EU sphere of influence even more. And the Dutch voters, by, 61-62%, told them that wasn't going to happen. And I'm fairly sure they might just ignore that one too, but we'll see.
Oh, they'll ignore any sort of popular referendum. And they'll say exactly what they're going to say with the Brexit vote. Well, it's not legally binding. You know, we can make these treaties, we can do this, that, and the other. And, you know, nobody can really argue against it because no one understands how any of this stuff works.
Yeah, I love the Brexit movie where they went around asking people how many presidents or something. They were like, oh, there'd be like one or two, and they're like, nope, three. It's like, what the hell? You have three people leading this shit? What's going on? I was like, how do you not know? And they were showing them pictures, and they were like, who's this guy? And they're like, I don't know. I'm like, oh God, you know you need to pull out of this shit when you can't even tell who the people are representing you. Like, that's scary. But
it's definitely scary. You need a degree in some cases. They have degrees in European Union, you know, in European studies they call it. And much of it is just learning about these opaque processes in the European Union because they make so little sense, and it's just such a vast bureaucracy with so many different departments, so many different moving parts. it's there's no way for the average layman to actually understand what's going on there. And that probably is one of the reasons why people want to get rid of it.
One of the jokes I often make, and then some people just don't get it when I make it, I was like, well, thank God to Britain for the first Brexit, which of course made America. And they're like, I don't think that's the same thing. And I'm like, ah, thanks a lot for not getting the joke. But, you know, come on. How many times does England have to make the choice that they want some damn freedom? Because, you know, they made the right choice coming here, making some colonies, and decided, you know what? We're tired of your taxation without representation. You know what? We're going to decide we're going to do this the right way and make America. And there's a lot of liberty here, or there was. And we're starting to see some similar stuff where we're getting up. We got this gigantic bloated government. And so what I've been seeing here in the U.S. after what happened, Brexit, a lot of people seem to not understand. Every time I say, hey, this seems like a good thing to me, because it seems like they decide to take, you know, into their own hands, get freedom and liberty, and people don't seem to value that as much as libertarians do, which is a scary thing, because I mean, I feel like America was founded on finding liberty and freedom. That was an important thing to the founding fathers. If you know anything about the actual original Constitution, this was important to them. And it seems to be a value that Americans have lost, and they're not seeing this at all in Brexit.
But Kim,
I think you should try and put it. Sorry, Tom.
But Kim, what if they use that freedom and liberty to not let brown people into their country? That would just be ridiculous. That would be so terrible. And we need to take away their freedom and liberty so that anybody that wants to be in England can be there.
Well, there's this system. It's called voting.
If you want to point out to an American audience, you know, the kind of basic question of national sovereignty, then try to turn the EU towards an American example. What if the USA joined like a union of Americas, which went from Canada up in the north down to Argentina in the south, and had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people inside it, and it had a parliament based in Mexico, and it had a Supreme Court based in Panama.
Montreal.
Well, you know, and it forced fishermen off the coast of Maine to give up their fishing grounds so that Canadians could fish there because they'd taken too many fish already, and it subsidized, you know, American farmers to overproduce milk and leave their fields unfarmed for half of the year. And it took a massive net contribution from the USA so that they could build sewers in Bogota and Rio de Janeiro with American taxpayers' money. If you actually asked Americans if they wanted that kind of arrangement, where they're going to create an army for the Union of the Americas and eventually graduate away from having a USA towards just having an American superstate for all of the countries in North and South and Central America, how many people would actually support that? I'm sure there would be some.
An unfortunate number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll bet you 70% of people would tell you that that's a dumb, stupid idea.
Yeah, no, there'd be a lot of opposition to it for sure.
Yeah.
One of the things about Brexit that I will say is a credit to you, British folk, is that here in America, because all of our journalists are just hacks and all of our people are just fucking hacks, they cannot get beyond sticking the suffix "gaped" onto every situation that happens. You know, they would have called Brexit "Leavegate." They seriously would have been that hacky to say, oh, it's Leavegate. You know, it's one of those things that, okay, cool, Watergate was an important moment, but you can't stick "gate" onto the end of words where it doesn't make any sense.
Deflategate.
You call that your, like the whole Michelle Fields incident was called Grabgate.
Oh my God, that was awful.
I shit you not, it was called Grabgate.
That's so stupid. What did they call Brexit then? Was it like, oh, you said Leavegate. That's No, I just got it. That's so stupid.
They would call it like leave gate or like separation gate or something. Some just utterly tacky, uncreative name that, you know, Brexit's a cool name. It rolls off the tongue. It captures exactly what the whole idea is about. Britain, Brexit, boom, smashed together. What's that? What is it called where you smash two words together? It's,
portmanteau. Portmanteau.
There we go. Thank you. Guy from the country that invented English. Thank you.
Yeah, once again.
I'm fairly sure that's a French word, but...
I was about to say that's not...
In English, we're just allowed to grab words from other languages and then call them English words.
Yes, that's what I love about English. Yeah.
And also make up new words. English is the language where the word irregardless, which at first was an error in language, was used so often that eventually they just added it to the dictionary.
Yeah. Well, that's what I love about English. If a lot of people use the word, and it can be integrated into the language if it's used a lot.
Yeah, now Merriam-Webster has selfie in their dictionary.
Which, you know...
So, we should all be proud of that.
I think that people used to think, because disgruntled was a word, they used to think there was a word called gruntled. There never was. But they decided to make it a word. Well, they actually did make a word. There was no such thing as gruntled before, and then everybody, yeah. Sorry, nerdy English stuff.
I was on the American office where he's like, nobody's disgruntled. They're all perfectly gruntled.
Yeah, that actually wasn't a word before. That I know stupid stuff. I have an English degree. I just, stupid stuff. Whatever. Anyway, but the other thing people would throw my way, and this was my favorite, and this is the last question I have before we go into a free-for-all to end the podcast, but... The foreign policy, of course, any country that's connected to a gigantic bureaucracy. One of the things people would throw at me about Brexit was, Putin is off smiling about this. How does this affect foreign policy for all countries? How's this going to be a problem? Why the hell is Putin smiling? How's this going to affect everybody? Like, what's going on there? Should people be worried now? Is this some sort of victory for Putin, guys?
I'm fairly sure Putin's not going to be able to go and annex Germany all of a sudden just because Britain has left the EU. It's actually troubling what people are asking for in response to Putin, because the EU is constantly pushing to have a European army now. And I think 2 days after Britain cast its vote in the referendum, they outlined some new plans to keep moving on with the European army. So the question I ask is, what increases the chance of us having a massive, disastrous, devastating war with Russia? Well, probably if we have one united, massive European army, rather than if we have 28 different small national armies, we'd have some kind of interest in keeping the peace and not annoying the Russian bear too much. I don't want to see Russia steamrolling over places it doesn't belong, but at the same time, I would rather that we, you know, tolerate something like what they did in eastern Ukraine than go and start World War III over a small parcel of land which feels Russian in the first place. So, in terms of foreign policy, I don't think a lot will change. One of the concerning things for me is that a lot of Leave campaigners were actually kind of on the neocon side. People like Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, and Gisela Stewart, members of this group called the Henry Jackson Society, which has never seen a war that it doesn't like the look of and believes in spreading liberal democracy around the world. For foreign policy, this could actually be, this might be more of a threat to Putin in reality, because it might mean Britain aligning more with the USA and being... even more aggressive against Russia. So you could argue it both ways. It could be a good thing because it limits Europe building up one single army. It would be a bad thing because it means us joining forces with America and the Commonwealth more and being hawkish. I don't know where it takes us, to be perfectly honest, but I don't think it makes a huge difference either way.
Yeah, I think he's right on that. I don't think when it comes to Putin and the possibilities of World War III, it begins and ends with America. If America decides to continue to push its way closer and closer to Russia, to try to put more and more missiles on the Russian border, to completely and utterly eliminate the buffer zone that Russia once enjoyed in Eastern Europe, that will risk starting war. I mean, one of the things I heard that just blew my mind is that this summer, America and Poland are running a joint military exercise with something like 20,000 troops, I think like 10 and 10 from each, about 50 miles away from this sort of 10-mile stretch of Russian land that nobody's ever heard of, right on the Polish border. And Putin has come out and said multiple times in the Russian media that any encroachment on any part of Russian territory will be met with a nuclear first strike. And yet you have, you know, the U.S. And its allies running these military exercises that, to Putin, look exactly like invasion drills. It's exactly what they look like, and it's probably what they are. You know, these military exercises that they're running, I mean, you know, you got to believe that the Pentagon has wargamed this thing 6 ways from Sunday about how to invade Russia if and when they decide they need to. You know, but they're... This narrative of Putin, you know, being on the warpath and trying to rebuild the old Soviet Union. I mean, Putin has done everything almost from a purely reactionary point of view. You know, the coup in Ukraine was executed by the United States. And this whole bringing Ukraine into the EU, which would have brought, you know, trying to fold Ukraine into NATO. I mean, what the hell does NATO still exist for? NATO is an anti-Soviet Union alliance. The Soviet Union no longer exists, and yet we still have an explicitly anti-Russian, you know, block of countries out there putting missiles in all of them, and yet somehow the American media gets away with this narrative of Putin and the Russian bear coming out to get all of us.
Fear-mongering works. It's, you know, it's always been a great tool for, and Americans fall for it every damn time. Well, you know, not all of us, obviously. So, anybody else have any topics that you want to cover? Because we just went over all the questions I had, but feel free to throw out anything that you can think of possibly gracing the ears of our audience with.
I actually have to sign off and go get some Chinese food before they kick the Chinese people out of the country. Those terrible racist xenophobes here in America.
All right, then. Well, thank you, Chad.
Well, gotta get it while you can. It's been enjoyable. All y'all listening, I'll be back at some point in the near future, wherever they'll have me.
All right.
You, my terrible racist, bigoted, xenophobic libertarian.
All right, you get out of here with your white privilege. No white privilege. Right. Hate all you white people.
Yeah, white privilege over in the kitchen.
Yeah, you take that somewhere. Get out of here. Just kidding. Love you, Chad. All
right. Yeah.
Bye. All right, then, Harris. Do you have any other details you can possibly...
No, I think that's everything. I'm happy to leave it there. It's been really nice talking with you. And good night.
Well, thank you for jumping on. We totally gave you like a day's notice, so thank you for jumping on. It's probably like, I don't even know what time over there at this point. But
1:30 in the morning, but that's not too late, right?
Well, feel free any other day you feel like, or maybe one of these days I'll sacrifice being up at some weird hour, and you can always come back on the podcast any point in time if you see a topic or you think of a topic that you would like to cover on the podcast, because we always like to have guests that we've had on before jump on to co-host or talk about any topic. So you're welcome to come back on, and thank you for being the person that actually got to vote and actually lives there that was on the podcast, so it didn't sound like Americans talking about shit they don't know anything about.
Well, it's been a joy. I'd be happy to talk to you again.
All right, and for the audience, you want to go ahead and give us your opinion or send us some feedback, you can do that by finding us on Twitter, at Newborn Liberty. Send us an email at newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook group. Just search out Newborn Libertarian. And we're also on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and probably lots of other places that I cannot think of at this point in time. But until next time, thank you for joining us.